Welcome in. Welcome back to another edition of the Legacy Right. I am the legacy of Jennifer and Kaiser. This is Andrew Joseph, and we got yet another special guest coming on board with us today. But Andrew, before we go, jump into this. You know we got to do this. We got to jump on the plug. We got to plug in the ad. We got to promote small business. So let's go ahead and do that. So
Okay.
fanghornforesters.com for all your woodworking needs, necessities. You can get yourself a nice little knickknack of a knife cutting board. I mean, coasters, bowls, anything of the sort. And if you're in the greater Cincinnati area, how about some millwork? So and other things my cousin does. So but fanghornforesters.com, and that's about it. So let's get straight to the show, and hopefully it's a good one. I think it'll be a good one. So welcome in to Jack Lloyd. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm good. Thanks, Zach. Thanks, Andrew, for having me on. I am appreciative to be here, and I'm excited to talk to you about all kinds of things, whatever floats your boat in liberty or otherwise.
Sounds good. That's why we brought you on, and I'm glad that Andrew he mentioned you. He mentioned we should get Jack Lloyd on. I'm like, all right, man. Well, you be the one to do the honors. So I've been getting everybody else recently. So you got this. So and then as soon as he sent me the screenshot of you accepting, I'm like, okay, let's work something out. So and I'm glad we did it. So thank you for coming
Yeah.
on and doing this for us. So Andrew, anything to start off?
What for the conversation?
Anything. So just for the conversation or anything to just plug away or if you want to sing a tune, it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, if money talks, Bitcoin sings, right? So I guess we could start talking
Exactly.
about crypto, talk about Bitcoin Cash, or we could do all kinds of other stuff. It's up to you.
That sounds like a plan. Let's jump into the crypto scene. Yeah. So you know more about it than me, man. So why don't you
Yeah.
jump into it and start it?
Well, Jack, what do you think about Bitcoin Cash?
I don't do much with Bitcoin Cash directly. I've interfaced with it here and there. Obviously, it's Bitcoin Fork, and some people argue over which is the real Bitcoin. I know Roger Ver was a big fan of Bitcoin Cash, right? So I think it's always fun to see what types of ways people implement Bitcoin technology. And obviously, as things are getting up to scale and bigger blocks and all this other stuff, and there's centralization issues. Certainly seeing more opportunities for people to have alternatives to Bitcoin while still using the same technology can be useful. And as always, it's up to people in the market to adopt. And that's going to be the biggest indicator of what's going to be successful is whether people will find it useful for themselves. And certainly whatever would process a bit faster these days would be useful for actually using for commerce, not just buying it as a store of value or future thing to hold. So I know a lot of people have gravitated toward Bitcoin Cash just because of that speed and lower fees here and there from what I've seen over the years. But outside that, I don't have much of a particular opinion about it. I obviously like anything that's more privacy oriented, like Monero and things that have strong use cases for the idealization of what Bitcoin could be. Because obviously Bitcoin wasn't a privacy coin from the beginning, but it certainly started the path. So
I think that
oh,
sorry.
go ahead. No, go
No, I
ahead.
say it definitely it wasn't a privacy coin, and but there is the potential for, decentralization with Bitcoin Cash compared to Bitcoin, because they have things like Cash Fusion and stuff like that, and that leads into the potential for having more anarchy in the monetary system. I think it's a lot healthier in the long term for the United States and for the world. So
And that I'll go ahead and ask this before I'll get it out of the way. But what if crypto is great? I mean, it allows for a competitive edge. It allows for an alternative option next to the fiat dollar or whatever other garbage paper currency that anybody else is forced to use. But what happens if, say, China launches an EMP attack and knocks off the power grid? How would what would that do for crypto then? So I don't think there would be any ability to even use cryptocurrencies in that, right? So let's jump into that scenario.
Well, I mean, I know that the blockchain is on satellites outside of the geographic parts of the Earth that people should still access it. And I mean, let's be realistic, that an EMP is going to take out the entire world's internet infrastructure. So it's a pretty far reach. What do you think, Jack?
I think that, yeah, when it comes to those types of doomsday scenarios, there's always that inherent problem that if you have something that is that devastating, in a world war kind of sense, on a next level, then, you'll probably have bigger issues to worry about. You'll need more than, just gold and silver and stuff like that. You'll need other survival things. So, when it comes to the bigger picture about, which is, really a topic of prepping, crypto is just one among many tools toward helping someone have independence and autonomy, and especially in case of emergency situations. So I personally would say to anybody, don't become too reliant on just one thing. If you're looking to try to diversify for emergency situations, you want to have multiple options for yourself, just in case, depending on situations of threat and access to electricity or whatever else. But certainly I wouldn't say to shy away from technology out of fears of a worst case scenario. Like, technology is always
Of
going to be
course.
the thing that enables you to survive and do better, because of the opportunities and enables you and how it makes you wealthier. So, it's not a reason to shy away from it, but it's just something to be realistic. If you're concerned about a true World War III situation, that you want to definitely have more than crypto. You're going to need some seeds, you're going to need some guns, you're going to need some water filters, you're going to need some things to help survive over, a cooling off period, for war purposes, and then coming back to the surface period, if you know what I mean. But for most people, it's not going to be something that they're realistically ready for. Prepping is kind of a serious thing. You can steward toward it over time, collect certain things and items over time, but not too many people have the full scale bunker, right? Not too many people have the underground bunker with the filtration and the prevention for radiation poisoning and all that stuff, and iodine pills and nuclear winter blankets. So that's a next level lifestyle kind of thing. But in the meantime, it's fine to enjoy many ways to help just diversify and keep yourself afloat depending on what's going on in the market.
Yeah, and that the prepping is great. I mean, it's kind of a good laugh too, because I think a lot of people get a little overboard, just because it's like a what if scenario. Like, oh, shit hits the fan, we got to get ready for this and that. But in reality, like, I think the best way to prep in any scenario is just understand, like, just the realities of everything. Like, if just doing little things here and there, like learning how to garden, or learning how to go learn how to hunt, go hunt, learn how to just build or craft certain things. I mean, that's what's gonna prep you. I mean, you don't necessarily have to, like, stack up, like, consistently, if you actually just over time teach yourself and teach others how to do certain things. So, I mean, prepping, I mean, in the long term is great, but I think in a short term, it can help you for the long term.
Just remember ATF: alcohol, toilet paper, and firearms.
Definitely lots of toilet paper, right?
Well, I mean, if we run out of toilet paper, there's leaves. I mean,
Yeah.
I'll go outside and grab a leaf.
Right. So, What do you guys think about the police system in the United States? Do you think we're heading towards more decentralization, more privatization, or do you think it's becoming a more significant centralized issue?
Oh, I say scrap it, but I'd like to hear what Jack has to say about the options in policing.
Sure. I mean, well, when it comes to policing, I think it's becoming more centralized. Certainly over time, more and more agencies have had power collected and federalized in many ways, and have had sheriffs that are elected move toward mayor appointed city police departments and things like that. I think that defense has become more distributed, not what police do generally in terms of justice, but I would say we've certainly moved more and more toward people taking their security seriously on a personal level, more people getting armed, more people having home security and video systems, right? It's become much more popular technology. So I'd say the prevention of crimes and people being able to kind of, get justice through their own mechanisms has increased a lot with technology. But in the meantime, and especially when you talk about cities, police power has increased, and to a degree, they're even weaponized to not do things, selectively, as you saw with the 2020 lockdowns and shutdowns, and police just letting certain bad things happen and then arresting innocent
Oh,
people,
yeah.
right? So a lot of politicization of these militarized police forces in cities. So it's kind of a weird situation that where we're in, because I would say more than ever, people don't want to rely on police generally. Like, people are open to it, but we haven't had any material legal backdrops change that would open the door for more private alternatives, at least in a novel way. Obviously, there's private investigators, there's private security, all other stuff, but there hasn't been anything I think, in a legal sense that fundamentally changes the relationship with individuals and police. The best that we've got has mostly just been, again, in the security, not necessarily justice. So we're talking about having constitutional carry, or states like reaffirming self-defense rights and things like that, and that's great. But it's just not the topic of police and justice, in terms of having that become more decentralized or market oriented. I don't think we've seen too much of that happening over at least the past 20 years.
Yeah, and that leads me to a question. Like, what's if we go a more private stuff, a privatization path? What's stopping private police from becoming just as corrupt as even with competition? I think this might happen, but what's stopping a privatization of police? Not becoming gang-like almost scenario where we're just having mercenary fighting mercenary, and it's not about security, it's more about just kill off the competition and then reap for the bottom line. So how do we ensure that doesn't happen in a private society?
I actually talk a bit about that in my book, A Vision for a Libertarian Future, in terms of transition, because where we're starting right now, obviously, is not, in a free market future. So we need to think about what steps we take to get there. And I'd say that when it comes to government and police and what goes on there, we first need to have a compared to what, right? What happens with police and the government now? Well, as it stands, the police and the government have this monopoly on violence, where they can make the rules for themselves. They take your money, whether you agree with them or not, and they give themselves qualified immunity or outright immunity for judges, where they can get away with a lot of things and face no material scrutiny or justice. So effectively, many police forces act as mafias already, because they enact violence against people en masse over victimless crimes. And police do good things in actions. Like, there are specific acts that police do. It could be arresting a murderer or a robber, rapist, and that's good. But when it comes to the totality of all they do, we have to also look at not just their actions and what's good. We have to look at how they're funded, and we have to look at the things they do that are bad. And when you take a look at that total picture of the funding mechanism, that's by force, and everything else I do with victimless crime laws, it's not really a net positive in the end, because they're spending so much time doing arrests of people who just have a plant, or who just want to defend themselves, or who just want to sell raw milk, right? So, you know, the war on drugs and several other government programs that could be hard on crime, where the crime is actually victimless, has created this huge prison system in the U.S. where we do have this massive body of people who are behind bars under, you know, our taxes being paid for them to just live, and they haven't actually hurt anybody. There's no victim. So we kind of live in that dystopian reality to some degree already. So when we're talking about what are the alternatives in the private market, I think that it's twofold. We have the difference of incentives, right? When you're not forced to pay a group, no matter what they do, the incentives change, right? Because now you can't just go ahead and like pick winners and losers through violence and think, oh, okay, and people are just going to keep supporting you. Just like any business that, you know, does something bad, they can face public backlash. People like, no, I don't want to shop with them. They're going to, you know, dissociate and go with another. You can't do that with, you know, the U.S. State or state police. You can't say, well, you know what? I think I'd rather have this police department. They seem like as if they actually care about my rights and they don't want to go after victims of crime laws. I'd rather support that. You don't have that, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So you get a little bit more of that in a private market solution, but it's not just simply policing, because policing in the paradigm we think about it is the you know, people who are just out there patrolling for crimes, looking for, you know, who's speeding and this or that. And free market justice isn't policing per se. Free market justice, free market defense is much more about customer oriented solutions and prevention, right? Like really what we're looking for is to have great prevention and you know, really meaningful checks and balances on people who are engaged in helping to stop bad doers. So, you know, that's really the direction that we'd be heading in, you know, is a private market and mostly preventative things. And then the question thereafter then is, okay, let's just say you have great private security, boom, they catch this person who's a burglar, right? Well, what happens next? This is where it gets, you know, interesting, because this is where some people have disagreements about what the ethical future might entail. For myself, I'm an advocate of the government turning toward a more market model, but still being ultimately viewed in the justice system as kind of the final decision maker, you could say. So what that means is that the government is no longer funded by force through taxation, right? That they have to get their money through voluntary means, but they would be the ones, and they would have public accountability for processing and dealing with the justice aspects of someone who victimizes another, where, again, this is not a contractual issue where you have two parties that can sign a contract and they say, we decide that this will be the arbitration, right? No, if you have someone that rapes someone randomly, that they have no contract, they have no privity, and they may even not be a part of any insurance or defense agency or anything, right? They could just be some mentally crazy person who just wants to hurt someone, right? And they don't have any privity or anything. So you need to deal with those situations. And I think people, as it stands, would probably be inclined toward that end, where there's a justice system that only deals with crimes of victims, that has public transparency and is voluntarily funded, you know, at its core. And I think that that's pretty much what we're looking at when we're trying to say what an ethical future entails. If you're a voluntarist or libertarian, the goal there is always to have all justice be revolving around property rights violations. So, you know, there has to be a victim. There has to be, you know, someone did something to someone else's body or property. And if you're going to have justice, it's, you know, chiefly firstly about restitution, right? The whole goal is that if you're harmed, you're trying to be made whole to whatever extent you can. It can't be done always perfectly, because there's some things that naturally you just can't undo, you know, a limb loss or a rape or something like that. But there's other ways to try to substitute in damages for that. And so I think that ultimately, in a free market, if the government actually went toward a free market, we would see a lot of different types of disputes end up having an independent market solution, especially when it comes to business transactions, you know, and things like that, where people actually actively contract. I think you would see solutions arise in insurance and dispute resolution agencies, where someone might have an insurance specifically if they are victimized, right? That's a part that would become an economic incentive part of life, where it's like you have something that covers you in the event that someone hurts you and you can't recover, right? It's, you know, for whatever reason, it's lost, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. And then I think there's going to be natural incentives for people to want to have some system of justice that has a finality to it, the idea that, okay, this is the highest level it goes, and this is the public justice system aspect to it. In other words, public visibility. And that leads to a stopping point, right? You don't want to have one person, they commit one crime, maybe they stole a candy bar, and it's like, okay, and now you have 10 different kangaroo courts that you have to go through, right? That was a big point, I think, of the American experiment and the American Western drive for the justice system we have, was this idea that you shouldn't have double jeopardy, right? That you should be tried, you know, once fundamentally, and that you shouldn't be put through the ringer multiple times for the same crime. I think that is a valuable lesson that the founding fathers learned and implemented. Of course, not perfectly, but it was certainly a huge leap for humanity. And I don't think that we should take that lightly. I think that we should certainly advocate for that, having, you know, when it comes to criminal justice, having some type of finality there with, again, voluntary funding, public facing, so there's transparency. And that's as good as you can get, right? When we talk about the market, you can only get as good as, hey, I can choose to fund this or not, right? Fundamentally, right? People are going to act, right? And many times they may act in ways you don't like. Many times they might act in ways that are wrongful. But at the end of the day, you know, the core ethical metric is, hey, we want to make everything as consensual as possible. And if we can get as close to that as possible, then we're light years ahead of where we already are right now. And I think that that is definitely a way to at least open the doors to possibilities for, you know, for new types of ways of thinking, you know, for justice. But you can't get there until you at least start opening the market there in the private sector a bit more.
Speaking of new ways of thinking, sorry, Zach, I'm going to jump in here just real quick. I remember seeing a couple of weeks ago, or maybe about a month ago, there was a launch of an app, and it was like a scripture model for like people who got pulled over by the police and stuff like that. And Zach knows what I'm talking about. I sent it to him. I should have brought this up before so we can play it, but we have short time. Basically, whenever you get pulled over, you hit the button, and it's like a speed dial for your lawyer, and the lawyer handles like the interaction between you and the police while you're in your car, like if you were speeding or they think you're drunk or something like that. What do you think about something like that? You think that has real potential, or is that something that's just gonna die out because not enough people will be able to finance that in the long term?
And I'm gonna butt in on here. You've been watching a lot of lackluster videos, haven't you?
Yeah.
At least that's where I saw it, but that's all I had to say.
Well, I mean, there's already many legal services that have subscription services. You know, there's various, you know, types of even with like trade unions and things like that, where they have legal aids and you could literally call them up anytime for questions, included, you know, with whatever it is that they're doing. So the concept's not new or unique. Just the technology and the ability to use the technology more immediately, you know, because you have an application that like hooks you up right away, you know, much more seamlessly than like, okay, I got to call up my lawyer real quick. So I don't think that that's weird. It's just like anything else. It's just a market function. You know, you need enough people who are like, yeah, I really would like that. I imagine people who speed a lot might be the ones to get that. I think people who are like, oh, I don't ever speed, might not care as much. Like, yeah, whatever, you know, I'm not going to need this, you know, but certainly, yeah, you're going to have people who are just like, you know, that would be useful for me. And who knows, you know, might be that they bundle it in with something else, right? They add it into a general legal service. You pay a monthly thing, which already exists. And boom, you can call up with legal questions. You get a certain number of hours a month, otherwise two included. So it's normal. It happens, you know, in many trades and, you know, other contexts that, you know, there's legal shield stuff too for gun owners, where they have, you know, legal services in case you need to use your firearm for defensive purposes. So yeah, I mean, it's certainly plausible that could be something that people find and adopt, and it could be useful. I think it was the ACLU. They came with something too before, where it was like, they had I don't know that it worked out, but they had some app where it was like a one touch button. You hit it and it would go dark screen on your phone. It would record the video and upload it to the cloud for you. So it would like have a recording and it'd be immediately backed up. I'm not sure. I haven't followed up with that, like where that went, but I remember them saying something about that, where they had an app that's like, if you get pulled over, click this, it records it and it's backing up to the cloud actively, and it has a dark screen. So it doesn't, he doesn't you know that you're recording, you know, the police officer. So
I just figured it was kind of disrupting. Disrupting in the way that because there's a lot of they have a lot of pressure when they pull you over and stuff like that. So I figured that could create a lot of tension between the police departments and the lawyers and create some kind of real momentum in the right direction, I think, because of the backlash.
And that's what's brilliant about a market strategy is like the innovations and the creations that come about. I mean, without having the ability to be able to juggle all this, I mean, where does that put people? I mean, you're it's just going to cause people to be stuck in a bind at that moment. And I mean, the fact that you have these subscription services that are like brought about, like who would have ever thought that you could just have a way to spout off some legal jargon with the police, like from your phone. Like, I mean, that's or something like Life Lock for like somebody, it's like an old person that could wear something around their collar and or their neck, and they can press a button if they fall and the EMTs show up or whatever. Like that's what the brilliance of like the market-based economy is, because it allows for that creation. Now, if only we can just erode that intellectual property, and then we can start seeing a little bit more competition. But that's what I see on the whole ordeal, is just the bright ideas that come about. So, and speaking of IP, Jack, what are your thoughts on intellectual property and what should we do about
it? Well, I definitely don't believe in government orchestrated intellectual property. I think it's oxymoronic as well, because ideas, even when put in a fixed form, they are not themselves scarce. The drawing that you make is scarce. Product you make is scarce, but the idea itself is non-scarce. And so in that environment, of course, many people are going to be worrying about how things get invented. They'll say, what are the incentives? And what we have to remember is that we sit atop of so many different giants of invention that we just take for granted every day that we don't have to pay royalties on, right? Imagine if you had to pay royalties every time you used a fork or a spoon or a fire, right? And now that's like, oh, it's very simple. But every technology, continues to become simpler and simpler in retrospect compared to the latest thing. And people will innovate when they choose a funding model that makes sense, where they can get what it is they need for capitalization, but without having to rely on the government doing violence, for them to do so. And I don't think that's too hard to imagine, because we've already seen what that's like in the current environment, thanks to so many different ways that ideas can be copied and inventions can be readily ripped, in China, where it's like you could send something over there and guess what? 6 months later, there's already knockoffs, right? So people have already had to adapt with ripping music, with LimeWire and Napster and all that stuff. They had to adapt. They realized, oh my gosh, we can't just rely on people buying our digital downloads. And they started to do live concerts and have specialized merch and do things to, up the sale value, right? And then others responded in kind too. They said, we could just release our music for free and then build a fan base like Arctic Monkeys did on MySpace. So you have people that adapted to the market and realized, okay, well, in this freeware and free share environment, we just got to maximize it for our popularity and monetize what's scarce. And people adapted. And so I think that applies in every area. It's not just art. It's also in, hard technologies and everything else. And what people don't realize too is that in this environment, everybody benefits from learning from each other as well. And that kind of open environment of ideas, everyone can then learn from each other. And it's a mutual benefit, right? If you discover something or innovate for something, and again, you're first to market, you do that well, but it's like someone copies it, right? It's like, okay, cool. But you can take what you have and now look at others too and adopt from them as well. So it's actually a race to the top, not a race to the bottom, because everyone is able to benefit from shared knowledge. And many companies have even already adopted this in software. For example, with making things open source and making things freeware and then doing services that are scarce, like Microsoft realized how valuable it is to actually have open source software, moved toward that, and then started to sell things like cloud services that, you know, are scarce resources on specific drives and databases. So, you know, that is how different companies adapt in that environment, realizing that, oh, okay, actually, if we can benefit from the world's knowledge and have the world look at this and improve this together, and then we can provide services and scarce resources, we can have a win-win. We can funnel in users to our products. So I think that, you know, fundamentally, the IP system does need to be done away with. And it will be shocking and it will be jarring for a lot of people, but like everything else in the market, people will adapt and they will go on to other means of funding whatever it is they want. And for myself, I already do those kinds of things because I use scarce resource platforms like Indiegogo and Fund My Comic to do my comic book series, which is voluntarist. So, you know, in that paradigm, I'm able to raise funds from fans directly because I have those special pages that are scarce. And they're, you know, to me, and I can let fans know, you know, where to support the next comic. And I don't have to worry about, oh, okay, well, is someone going to, you know, do something with a character, this or that? Rather, I just have to focus on how I reach people and tell them, you know, what I'm doing next, where the official source and channels are, you know, just like you have your own custom URL on YouTube, right? You have your own distinct channel. And I think in the market, people would naturally gravitate toward producing content and channels that have user agreements that respect those things, right? You want to be on a channel or that is a, on a platform where they say, hey, if you sign up with us, we will protect your videos on our site. So we won't let others on the site rip and re-upload and claim they're you. So we'll give you that identity protection, right? And that's valuable. And then you have that value, you know, for advertisers and all that good stuff. And then, you know, and then it's privately owned. So you have a private owner, which would be, a, you know, the video website platform corporation doing that thing. And then you have it, you know, with your domain name and ICANN registry. And that's, you know, a private company with specific discrete, you know, handles. And there you go. You can have authentication and authority of who owns what types of branding, like where it's, you know, coming from, without having to rely on government IP for those things. So yeah, I think it's not that crazy to imagine. And I think, you know, already so many have had to adapt to people being ready to, you know, rip things or copy things, and so we've just already watched a lot of that evolution, and it would just be a little bit more of that.
Andrew, you look like you have something to add.
Well, I was just thinking, you talking about the open source stuff, and the problem that we have with China stealing our hardware, and it makes me think of the RISC-V open source hardware that they've been developing. It's an open source CPU technology that all the big players like Google and stuff like that are actively trying to develop for, and it's based on ARM technology. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely it swings both ways. So
it's a two-way swing.
The pendulum.
Yeah, I mean, regardless, you're gonna have everybody vying for something, and everybody's gonna do something better, but. And there's going to be garbage out there, and that's how you adapt. I mean, you innovate. I mean, and with so many different red tape, I mean, it's hard to be able to go and, like, do your own thing and gravitate towards something to that's greater than the other thing. Like, so you get rid of that red tape, and in my opinion, it's just a better world. I mean, I'd rather Joe Smoke down the street sell, invent a walking pencil. I don't know. I just grabbed that from my head, a walking pencil, and then I do the same thing. Only mine has a jetpack on it that flies into your fingers, and yeah. So just and there, somebody's still gonna buy his stuff, but someone's gonna want mine, and then someone else is gonna be like, what? What the fuck is this?
It's a widget. That's what it is.
It's a widget. So.
Yeah.
Well, with all that in a voluntary society, what is the difference? What is the difference? We always try to figure out the similarities towards libertarianism or the one with the big L. and anarchy or voluntarism, however most people want to refer to it as. The nicer way is voluntary. The scary is anarchy. But the differences between libertarianism and anarchy, how do we use those differences to kind of bring about a more voluntary world?
Sure. I mean, Big L libertarianism encompasses both sometimes the concept of the Libertarian Party. It also encompasses people who are philosophical libertarians, but who have a stopping point of being like, okay, you know, I'd be fine with like a night watchman state or a minarchy. In other words, a very small government that has maybe just stuff with what they would say is national defense, police, courts, that kind of thing, fire department, that kind of thing. Everything else, those is a free market otherwise. I think that it's kind of always just a matter of shooting, you know, for the stars, landing on the moon. I am a voluntarist, anarcho-capitalist philosophically. I shoot for that as far as I can go in the hopes that maybe if we're even lucky, we'll get to a minarchy. But that's the thing you have to do is you have to be radically principled or you won't even get to that. Because if you have any area of your philosophical thought that makes an exception for statism, that exception is what is going to go forward, not the liberty. Always the exception for growing government. So unless you have that consistent philosophy where like, nope, the size, scope, and power of the state all have to be reduced across the board, no growth anywhere, no stay the same anywhere, we got to cut it all down, at least that will let you get to a point of true liberty and even to a point where if you get the market free enough, in my opinion, you will actually just outmode the government anyway, right? If you if you get to a certain point there anyway, you're going to have people in the private market come up with solutions where people are just going to kind of not choose the state. Just like anything else, just like you might be like, oh, I'm going to choose FedEx or UPS for a package instead of USPS, you know, for something that's above 13 ounces. So I think that that is the key to actually getting people to think outside the state is free market, you know, principles. And the more we have those, the more abundance we will see, and the more we will be able to see solutions rise up that actually start to make the state obsolete. So, you know, that's why I just care about the principles of liberty first and foremost, is that if you can get someone to have that kind of sovereign mindset, you know, thinking outside the state, then you're golden, because you'll just consistently reject any exceptions. And maybe you'll get some anarchy, maybe you won't, but either way, you're not going to be a part of that problem of expanding the government, because you're like, yeah, I'm going to vote for the lesser of two evils. Like, we need, you know, government to do this violent thing here, you know. So if we can get out of that thinking, then we have solved, you know, 99% of the problem for an individual in terms of, you know, getting to liberty. So.
And what do you think the partyarchy for that? What do you think the partyarchy is so quick to compromising in socialist philosophies, or not philosophies, but socialist institutions, where, I mean, we got to have a fire department, we got to have police, we got to have some sort of defense. Like, why is it that the partyarchy is so quick in making those compromises instead of just full on trying to adapt on a better standard to mitigate that public sector and try to use more private innovation?
Well, anything with political incentives, you know, comes with very often the incentives for central planning mindsets from people, right? People who are thirsting for state power often want to control things and puppeteer things and, you know, do things in their way or their better version of government. So I think that there's always that incentive that, you know, people are attracted to those places. Yeah, people who are halfway libertarians or just on the path, but not, they didn't do the intellectual work to get there and become principled, who come in. So unfortunately, it's just the nature of being in that political arena that you're going to have people who are not all the way there, which is why I always advocate that if you're doing anything within the political arena, you better have strong entryism and education for members. You need to make sure that the people who are coming into leadership positions are completely principled and have a long-term you know, proof of that. And anyone who's coming by should be learning about the ethics and economics. They should be learning Austrian economics, They should be learning voluntarist ethics, and they should be walking away from your events and whatever else it is you got going on with more knowledge, more information to combat the brainwashing, the status brainwashing that's 24/7 from the mainstream news and everywhere else, from schools and stuff like that. So if you don't have that routinely, then you have people who are just obsessed with the political side of things, that is trying to win in politics, and that's all they care about, and they lose sight of what the whole goal of what it is they're trying to do. That said, of course, I do think that there are plenty of wonderful people who are participating in those things, and there's also plenty of not so great people, grifters, bad actors, liars, two-faced people. So you know, it comes to the territory in politics, especially. It's not like, you know, there aren't those people outside of it, but inherently politics attracts a lot of sociopathic types and people who are, you know, chomping at the bit to get power for themselves and feel self-important. So it's an unfortunate aspect of it, but as always, doesn't matter who it is, politics or not, my goal, and anybody who's in my circle of what I like to do, and I think y'all would probably agree, the goal is to get other people to be as principled as possible, right? We want to change minds for liberty. We want more and more people to become robust economic thinkers, peaceful parents, people who are like, yeah, I want to get my kids out of state schools. I'm tired of this. Like, we want a true cultural change, you know, all the way across, you know, the grassroots, and then to percolate up in the culture, as we've been seeing, actually, I'd say, you know, even like with Javier Milei, you get to a point where the downstream with politics starts to look a little bit more and more libertarian over time. You're like, okay, they're picking up our talking points, right? They're picking up some of our policies. You know, where's this going? So that's really the goal, is you want to have that level of an impact on others that it's lasting, and it causes that cultural change.
And speaking of Milei, what are your thoughts on Milei and what's going down there in Argentina? Do you perceive it as something that might be kind of like the sprout over the eyes, and maybe it's something that most, you know, we want to see is something good, but in reality it's probably the same old, or is this really is he really going to be the real deal in libertarianism down there in Argentina?
I believe he's the real deal. And the reason why I do is because you have to look at his history, his actions and words, right? There's lots of people who just say certain catchphrases, or they'll pay lip service. But this guy has been saying the same things consistently for over 10 years. And he literally knows Austrian economics, taught people that on big major shows. Like, this guy was kind of like a personality rock star person. He had some celebrity dumb for being this guy who would like sing and dance and be entertaining and also teach people about economics. So this is not someone who just gave lip service. This guy literally was out there changing minds of the culture in a consistent way that you can go back and look at. This is not some behind the closed doors thing. You can go back and watch years old videos of him teaching people about economics and talking about Rothbard and talking about Mises and, you know, literally calling socialism like the worst thing ever, you know. So this is not someone who I believe is faking this. It would be very difficult to be so consistent for so long and to be faking it, because it's, you know, very often when you see people who are, you know, CIA plants or patsies and all sort of stuff, you don't get this kind of depth, this intellectual depth and engagement. They're not able to really talk the talk and walk the walk for years and it be really meaningful. So his work, I think, kind of speaks for itself. And already, when you look at what he did just coming out the bat, within the first month, he's cut more government than any other person has ever done ever. You know, more than Ron Paul ever did, which was basically nothing. More than Massey, more than Rand Paul, more than Amash, more than really anybody. There's basically nobody you can point to who actually has done what he's done. It's something that's honestly like unfathomable. And what people don't understand is that when it comes to his restructuring plan, he can't just be like, let me go to like ANCAP day one. It doesn't work that way. You know, he's the president. He's not the dictator of all things. There's still other government officials, agencies, stuff like that. He can only work within a certain boundaries of power. And he has to do things incrementally because the country owes the IMF money. And they have to actually recapitalize and get out of their debts. They can't just default on those things or it's going to be extra worse. So he had to restructure things where he's like massively cutting the government, massively cutting regulations. He switched the tax structure at first to where it was an income tax where they didn't have it for a little bit, which was really cool. But then he cut taxes on imports and other things to balance that out. So he switched where the taxing structure was, but he's doing that to recapitalize the country so they can get out of debt and free up the market. And basically ratchet Argentina up toward economic freedom to be in the, you know, the top 50, I would think, maybe even more, depending on how far he can take it. It's just, it's not all in his court. You know what I mean? That's the thing, is that, and at the end of the day, he is not the entire legislature. He's not their courts. He is just the president. And the president only, in his case, had some unique extra powers because the socialists from before strengthened that office and gave it extra powers to implement more socialism, right? So this kind of thing backfires on them in a glorious way. Like normally we know, you know, in America, right, when the Republican does it, oh, well, it's okay that, you know, that they had extra strengthening of the government. They're doing it for the right reasons this time, right? In this case, Javier came into the position where it was already strengthened because it's supposed to support the socialists. So he's like, ha, it's already strong. I could just cut so many different things. I don't even have to ask on a lot of different things. So that's just, it's a mind-blowingly crazy, unique opportunity. And they're still, of course, then working to put in checks and balances back, you know, afterward. So they're trying to gut the government, but then put in, and he has to, of course, put pressure on legislature and stuff like that. And there is good pressure. Like there's definitely like people get nervous because it's like, oh shit, you know, if he did this well, we're next for, you know, the chopping block in the legislature. So there are some people who I personally know who are actually going and visiting right now. And I'm excited to be talking to them, you know, when they come back. I want to hear more on the ground, what they're seeing over there, because obviously I'm not there. So I can only do my best looking at the, you know, secondhand information from other people. But I'm excited that I'm going to see some more information come through about the area from people who are actually visiting, which is also crazy because he went and privatized air travel, and all of a sudden, whoo! You could actually fly to Argentina, you know, now, you know, Buenos Aires, stuff like that. So it's like, you can actually get some flights. So it's just wild. This is like an unprecedented historical miracle. It isn't, and people who miss out on that are missing out on, you know, probably what is one of the coolest things to ever happen for libertarians and ANCAPs ever.
And makes you wonder why can't that happen here? Honestly, I mean, they were able to elect this, I mean, the most, probably one of the most socialist countries in the world. Like they were big time, big time socialists, and they were able to elect a president in Malay, and we're still vying over whether or not we want Donald Trump or Joe Biden in office for our next geriatrocy. I mean, why do you think that is, honestly?
Well, it's like with Trump winning, right? Trump won because the Democrats were cocky and they thought, we don't have to do anything. We got this in the bag. We got Hillary, right? They're just like, whatever. You know, we're gonna just sweep this. I think the same thing is with the socialists. The socialists in Argentina, they've been in power so long. They're like, yeah, whatever. We got this. It doesn't matter. And they're already broke. They're like 144th economically when they started. So things are already pretty desperate. So the socialists there got lazy with their power, and then the public, a significant number of them, were so over it, were so destitute and so devastated. They're like, no, we will literally take Javier Milei over the next Peronist, you know, person to come in. So that's what often is needed, unfortunately. You need the pain to stay the same, to be greater than the pain to go ahead and change before people change, right? You need that pain to be so much like, oh my gosh, okay, you know what? I'm going to change. So in America, unfortunately, we have a lot of wealth. I mean, fortunately, but unfortunately, because we have a lot of wealth here, the pain to get to changing takes a lot more erosion because there's a lot more to lose before you get to so much pain. Fortunately, I do think that the lockdowns and the shutdowns gave us a very nice, like, stabbing pain that, like, you know, shocked people awake, like, whoa, 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 hey. Like, that was really effective at actually waking people up without going, you know, total bonkers, you know, Zimbabwe level hyperinflation. So that was good. Like, that was like the shock that everybody needed to be like, whoa, hey, the government is this powerful. They can shut down your business and tell you that you're useless and, oh, you're not a necessary worker and all stuff. It definitely left a shockwave. So what I hope is that that continues to build And I think it has been. I think it has certainly shifted. I think culturally, when you see like what's happened with Twitter, now X, with Elon Musk and the people he's brought on, this or that, and you've seen what's happened to Javier Milei and the publicity surrounding that, I think you are starting to see a coalesce of different people coming together and really saying, okay, you know, it's time to get out of this deep state, Jeffrey Epstein, you know, pedal pal, you know, kind of complex here, military industrial complex. I think everybody's kind of like on the same page, like going like, okay, yeah, these people in DC really are the most evil, wicked people in the world, huh? Like people say that, like you can go probably to any, you know, store and say that to most people and they're like, yeah, you know. But we're not at the point where people are getting so desperate. They're like, oh, I'm going to do everything I can to change. But it's okay. We're just going to keep on changing minds in the meantime and telling people to think outside the state, support those who don't want to destroy your liberty, right? I think some of the small ways it's been done, right, with Disney, right? Disney and all the nonsense they've been putting out with all their, you know, preaching SJW nonsense, right? That's caused a lot of people to go, okay, you know what? I'm done with Disney. I'm canceling. I'm out. Right. And then people are going to alternatives. They're going to alternative media. So it's not like it's impossible. It just takes people being willing to say, okay, you know what? I'm going to change my spending habits a little bit. It doesn't have to be everything, but even if you're just like, you know, taking 10% out of the mainstream and I'm going to look for alternatives in the, you know, liberty oriented sphere, right? For entertainment or whether you want some soap bars or whatever it is, you're just shifting a little bit of your spending, right? Okay. You know what? I'm going to intentionally spend with those who care about my liberty. Just little bits at a time, and you can literally change things in massive ways. So and we are starting to see that. I mean, the exodus that happened with the social media platforms and the collapsing of all that stuff. I mean, the numbers and the writing's on the wall. Those are not going to be sustainable. You know, Disney is definitely running some big holes, and people are saying enough is enough, and that's starting to go across the board with different companies that went too far. And you know, lost a lot of money in the process because you're like, not, yeah, we're not going to do this, Budweiser. Thanks. So, that's what I anticipate is that I anticipate that this trend that we're seeing now, the seeds that have been planted in people's minds is saying, okay, enough's enough. I'm done. I'm going to go and I'm going to go get on Rumble. I'm going to go support this liberty oriented, you know, entertainment thing or products thing. That little bits that are starting to percolate. Those are going to have ripple effects because that money is going to be in the more liberty oriented economy, and it's going to continue to let those people flourish. And then that's going to grow. And then more people are going to trickle out of the mainstream as it gets just worse at all levels because they don't seem to learn very well. And I think we're going to see liberty in terms of the message win. It's going to get very tough. I think the people in power right now are very desperate. You know, Klaus Schwab and his gang. They're very desperate, you know, going as far as Klaus Schwab himself saying that libertarianism is anti-system. They are aware that the world is turning against them and is ready to stand up to their Agenda 2030 and the UN Sustainable 17 Goals plan. So it really is just a matter of keeping that message strong, letting people know that they're not alone, that we can do this. We can definitely exit out of this. We can continue just living our lives peacefully and finding and networking with people who do the same. And, you know, just disobeying this, like straight up just saying, no, I'm not going to go along with your stupid lockdowns and mask mandates and all this other stuff. And I'm not going to fund your stupid, you know, NGO corporate crony companies that want to put people into pods and make them have nothing and eat bugs. Like, screw that. So I think that people are really feeling those sentiments and are ready for a life outside of this toxic statism.
Oh, go ahead, Andrew.
I said there's definitely been some building confluence, and you know, I think the trend, like you said, is reversing. So then that's once it starts, it just gets, it's like a boomerang, you just can't stop it. So it's a lot of support that's been building over the last short while.
Definitely,
and one thing that I've recognized from studies and just in general, period, you can see it on the ground, like in your local neighborhood, really, is like, in order to beat desperation, always is the counter effect, the balancing of figuring out what to do when you're down and out in order to prop yourself up. And like in history, the Soviet Union realistically fell because most of the population was selling, buying and selling on the black market. So goes to my next question. What is your thoughts on agorism and how can it be utilized as a way to kind of gravitate towards that anarcho-capitalist mentality for society?
Sure. Yeah. Agorism is just people trading outside the state, you know, outside of sanctioned channels. I think that it is a tool among many tools for people to think outside the state and to build networks that are more resilient and, you know, not always having to rely on major chains of suppliers and stuff like that. And, you know, keeping things, you know, more outside the hands of the state. I think it's wonderful. I can't ever fully supplant what is in the mainstream market because obviously the government's going to come after it if it gets too big, but it is a wonderful way to think about some things. Again, just like we talked about crypto before, crypto is a novelty and a nice thing to have and certainly could become very valuable when you need it, if you need to send things across the world, especially privately like Monero, but it's one tool among many. So that, you know, that is a tool and a mindset that can help you think outside the state and can help you, you know, avoid participating in status schemes. So I certainly promote it as a tool toward that end.
And that's really all it is. It's a tool. It's not a society like ANCAPs want to promote. I mean, it's literally just a tool because, I mean, what is society anyways? I mean, but just a community of individuals just trying to chuck along and figure out this journey of life. So.
Definitely. Yeah, exactly. Society is an abstraction. It's individuals at the end of the day. You might have a community if you have a certain region of people who have, you know, shared interests or just, you know, shared daily arenas of where they operate, do business, you know, all that stuff, commute. But at the end of the day, it's individuals who think, it's individuals who act. And that's us, the individuals who are going to change the world for liberty. So,
Yeah, and that's I love the aspect of community, like the drive towards community. I mean, the whole talk anymore is collectivist ideology and socialism, and we need to maintain for the social order, right? And when it all comes down to it, like, community over collectivism is always going to be it's going to be better at the end of the day, just because, I mean, community is community, it's relationship, we need people. But collectivism, we're all drones and just worker bees, just slaves to a system. I mean, where it's just gonna crush us. So I mean, how do we, I mean, it's sad because, I mean, even if you get away from like the Twitter sphere, there's a lot of people in reality that are still stuck in that grind of that collective mindset that I got to go work and make all that overtime or else I'm not going to be able to provide for my family. Like, and in reality, I don't think you even have to do that in our society today. You don't have to kill yourself just to maintain. So how do we get that, flip that switch with like our neighbors and the letting them know, hey, you don't have to have this collectivist mindset. You don't have to have that mindset that you have to work into the grave just to survive.
Well, I mean, obviously each person and their individual circumstances is going to be different on what they need to do to provide for their families and survive. I would say that for me, the thing that matters most is the productivity aspect, right? We should be able to work less and have more leisure hours, but the government steals our productivity and makes everything way more inefficient because of all the regulations and wasted money on foreign wars and handing it out to a bunch of crony corrupt people around the world. So to me, that's where I like to remind people is like, if you are stressed and you're working like crazy, like, oh my gosh, why do I have to work a second job just to pay the same bills? And you're like, why is everything so much more expensive? It's like, yeah, that you should be mad. The government literally printed crazy amounts of dollars, you know, and put it into circulation with the omnibus spending bill, the second one with Trump. And obviously the government spent a lot of money too. So the government's debts, the government printing more currency has greatly devalued our dollar, our purchasing power of what we have. And that needs to be rectified. And the only way we get to that is by the government ending the fractional reserve banking system. That is, you know, allowing banks to lend out a certain amount. Well, and these days is actually zero, because in 2020, Federal Reserve said you only need 0%. So it's like practically zero. So, you know, the banks get all this extra currency out of thin air. We're stuck with this devalued currency, and everything's like 20%, 30%, 50% more expensive, depending where you go. And people are having to work more and get less. And it's unacceptable. It's, you know, we should literally be like 100 years into the future of technology already. And the government's stolen that from us. So I think getting people just to recognize that and to be mad, like, you got to get angry, like, no, this is enough. I'm tired of working extra jobs to only get less because the government wants to go and send, you know, billions of dollars to 10 different countries. You know, it's absolutely sickening. So, you know, I think that's what we really need to relate to the average person on, is their struggles and getting them to recognize that the government is the problem, that they're actually doing this intentionally to make us poorer, that this isn't just, ooh, an accident. This is intentional. And those in the state are robbing us blind, especially through the federal government, through their various policies, both on currency and on spending. So,
And sadly, also taxing us while we work in order to provide for the old people. So
taxing us for Social Security that is neither social nor secure, and they literally pillage those funds and lie about, you know, what they'd actually have, and they're just, you know, doing a giant Ponzi scheme. It's downright evil and it's wasteful.
Well, this has been a great episode. Cool. Thank you very much for joining us, Jack. I know you're on a strict time limit. So anything you want to say, Zach, before we sign off?
Well, I appreciate Zach and Andrew having me on real quick. So if I would, I just would plug real quick, check out Voluntarist. You can go to Jack, J-A-C-K-V, as in Voluntarist Lloyd, jackvlloyd.com to check out my comic book series. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about creating the parallel economy and thinking outside of the mainstream stuff. And if you're tired of Disney too, we got our new kids book out. This is super cool. The Unschooled Adventures of Jack and Pha. That's a kids book literally about unschooling and get your kids out of state schools. So that is another way to inspire families to leave the status paradigm. So we're just doing as many things as we can to get people inspired and creative outside of the SJW nonsense from Disney and the status nonsense from the government. So
fantastic. And that's what I like. I like the entrepreneurial spirit and just expanding everything, expanding the knowledge through whatever means. So, I mean, listeners, check out the comic, check out the book, get it for your kids for their birthday. I know Christmas is done. Get it for your kids for Valentine's Day. There you go. So, the little Valentine's, the Valentine's date. So, Jack, you're on, you're obviously on Twitter or X, or if you want to shout out anywhere else that everybody can catch you lurking.
I'm pretty much everywhere. You know, I got Facebook, I have Twitter, I have Minds, I have EastandC/Hive. You know, I have MeWe, I have Instagram. I'm all over the place. So you can find me definitely at my website, and then any of those other places, you know, volcomic.com, also where my comic book website is, V as in Voluntarist, V-O-L-C-O-M-I-C, volcomic.com. So check it out, doing a lot of cool things. And we also do music and music videos. So that's another thing me and my wife love doing, is having fun with that.
All at Tom Wood's house though, right?
Hey, yeah. We did do one at Tom Wood's house, and our latest one was great, The Great Reset, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So, well, fantastic. It was awesome that you came on and joined us and dropped some knowledge bombs. So, you know, it's been fun. So thank you again, Jack. So, Andrew, anything in your corner?
No, I'm pretty good. Thank you for joining us, Jack. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Andrew. It's my pleasure, Zach. Thanks for having me on.
No, thank you again. So once again, this has been, that's Lysander Spooner. The Legacy, right? If you can see it, I am the legacy of Jennifer Ant Kaiser. That's Andrew Joseph. That's Jack Lloyd. And let's try to find a way to lead on to a voluntary path of peace and prosperity for everybody. But it's going to be some hard work. So, but until then, peace.
See ya. Thanks for watching.
Thanks, guys.